Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim are my co-hosts. Gents, good to see you both again.
Good to see you.
Good to see you guys.
While the world is holding its breath as the conflict between Israel and Iran continues to intensify, late last week, Israel launched what it called preemptive strikes in Tehran and other Iranian sites. And of course, Iran retaliated. Let's take a step back, Rodney. Take us through what was Israel's motivation for striking Iran with missiles? And I guess, did it achieve what it wanted to achieve?
So the second part's a military question, and we'll find that out, I guess, further down the line, because there's been some discussion on whether or not it has the military capacity to deal with underground nuclear sites that are below, I don't know, some huge volume of rock or something, which requires a special type of device, which Israel apparently don't have. So that's one element. The other element, which is starting to come out as part of the discussion, is regime change. So I guess if those are the objectives, neither of them have happened so far. But, you know, a lot of this comes from, and if we go right back to the beginning, in, you know, October the 7th and what happened between Gaza and Israel then, what we've had since then is the idea that that the Houthis, that the Hezbollah and that Hamas would provide some deterrence to Israeli action against Iran has fallen away. And Israel was always going to have some point of conflict with Iran. They, of course, are saying that they're doing the world a favor in that they're stopping Iran arriving at the destination of a nuclear warhead, or a series of them through this enrichment that's taking place. But again, you know, this was all subject to an agreement that Trump unpicked. Trump was thinking he was negotiating with Iran, and at the same time, Israel's just gone it alone. Whether they've gone it alone with or without American encouragement, or you know, I don't know. The Americans seem to think that this is going to drive Iran back to the negotiating table, and I can't think anything would be further from the truth. As we see with most places where there's a where there's even a division within an administration or a country, once there's military action by an external party, people tend to fall into line and will back a regime and government that they maybe didn't plan to back. So I can't imagine that Iran are going to, in somehow, through these attacks, say to America, by the way, let's do a deal on the nuclear stuff now. I just think it's, you know, it's a regime that's under pressure anyway. I don't think it'll do itself any favors if it was to go down those lines, because its objectives to stay in power, and I don't think that that's a way for this regime to stay in power in Iran. So I think we're in a difficult position. There's no obvious off ramps within a short period of time. It feels like Israel, as they've done in Gaza, will just continue and cite that they are working through a series of military objectives. But, you know, Iran, from the strength of position it had 20 years ago when the West took out Saddam Hussein, Iran sought to have a proxy fight with the US in Iraq in the south. The West took out the Taliban in Afghanistan, releasing a potential pressure point on the other side of Iran. Iran was in a strong position. It then established the proxies or continued to grow the proxies in Lebanon, in Gaza with Hamas then, etc. And now it looks like Iran's in a very different position. And I mean, a little bit of what Netanyahu's doing at the minute feels a little bit like Putin trying to fulfill his destiny in Ukraine. A little bit of this does feel like an old man, and Netanyahu is now taking the action that he always wanted to or promised he was going to take at a time when he sees an opportunity because of other difficulties that Iran clearly has.
I mean, obviously, none of this would have happened if Donald Trump was president. So, let's start with that. I agree with everything Rodney said. I think Iran is in a significantly weakened position to what it was pre-October 7. Many of the proxies that it had in Lebanon through Hamas, all of these have been weakened. Pre-October 7, I think Israel would have struggled mounting such a attack on Iran, considering that there were about 30 or 40,000 missiles controlled by Hezbollah that would have been pointed towards Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities. However, that doesn't exist to the extent or to the degree that it did pre-October 7. So in some ways, it's a very opportune time for Israel to take this action. And I think whilst those Republicans and MAGA and President Trump to a certain degree are talking about how this was some sort of 6D, chess that Trump was playing to weaken Iran's position and pretend to have these talks, etc. Seems or it appears that either Trump is not being taken seriously by Netanyahu and Netanyahu is going ahead with his own agenda, or Trump, whilst he may have known about it, is not really in a position to say no to Netanyahu. So I think regardless of what happens, the bigger question here, I think, is whether Iran, sorry, what is the actual end game for Israel. I think if it's certainly regime change has come up, as Rodney has mentioned. But at the end of the day, even if they do have access to the bunker buster missiles that Rodney touched on, which only the US A has and B can deliver, it still doesn't really solve the longer term problem of Iran being determined and committed to have a nuclear weapon and potentially using it against Israel. So I think it comes down again to trying to find a way forward through some diplomacy when the time is right. Right now is probably not that time, considering that it's, I've always found in negotiations, it's probably best not to kill the people that you're negotiating with. So it really is not the right time, but when the time comes, they need to sit back at the table and perhaps Iran will be in a much weaker position then and may sign on to a deal that they may not have signed on to last week, for example. All of this, I think, is hypothetical because at this point in time, it looks like this thing is going to escalate even further. But it's not sustainable, I think. Even if Israel can postpone or prolong Iran's nuclear ambitions, this doesn't solve the longer term problem. What did solve the longer term problem was the deal that President Obama struck with Iran, and the very deal that President Trump, in his first term, decided to get the US out of and to cancel, mainly because it appears that his name wasn't on it or he wasn't the one that struck that deal. But that's been a big mistake, I think, of the US getting out of that deal and not being able to get Iran back to the table to sign another deal. Because as far as most commentators were concerned, that deal was working at the time. There was some criticism continue and criticism continues from particularly the right in the US and Republicans at the time that the deal gave Iran an ability to support proxy the proxies that Rodney referred to, etc. There's no evidence of that. In fact, If anything, the fact that the deal wasn't in place for the last 5 or 6 years has meant that Iran has been able to pursue and really go far down the track of getting nuclear weapons. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I don't think there's any end in sight to this. It can't continue the way it is. I don't think Netanyahu is going to be able to sustain having to send his citizens to bunkers every night as they fear ballistic missiles coming in from Iran. And at the end of the day, the Iron Dome has been successful, probably more successful than any other defense system, I suppose, in the region. But they are suffering casualties, and this is something that is going to, at some point domestically, start to hurt Netanyahu. Saying that, it seems very interesting that the whole world really is not, whilst everyone's calling for a de-escalation, no one's really talking about whether Israel did the right thing or not. And there seems to be a lot more appetite for Israel to continue this. Certainly the EU are not opposed to it, as they are with a lot of what Israel's doing in Gaza. And internally or domestically, there seems to be pretty significant support for these actions. So let's see what the next few weeks show.
Yeah, I think that's the point. Sorry, Erdem, but I think that's the point, Dozan, is within a few days, Israel's flipped European opinion to an extent, or at least neutralized it. I think Finland came out and criticized them for their actions towards Iran, but everyone else has gone from criticizing them on Gaza to either silent or softly supportive because of broader
Exactly.
concerns about Iran's nuclear ambitions. And then there's the other factor, and this is wonder why whether regime change is actually part of the conversation, which is Syria. And as much as Russia taking action in Ukraine was taken back to the manner in which the US gave up Afghanistan and looked like they weren't going to be a proactive military player and so on, in the same way that they previously were, and there was some criticism of that. Russia's failure to actually support the Assad regime gave a degree of confidence to Israel that Russia was in not willing nor in a position to do anything to support Iran. And I think that's pretty clear as well. I mean, Russia has not been, able to either work with Israel in some way to manage this down or provide some sort of support for Iran. And I do wonder whether there's some knock-on effect for weapons that Iran may have been supplying to Russia that may now have to be retained at home for this action in relation to Israel. There's lots of other elements to this that are going to play out over the coming weeks. It may well be that Russia is now self-sufficient in terms of the missiles it's producing and so on, but for a while it was relying on at least Iranian technology, if not actual hardware being shipped and so on, to continue the drone side as well. I think the one thing that we could probably get to the point of pretty quickly, Ozan, is that the prospect of Trump getting the Peace Prize looks further and further away. And that's one of his biggest ambitions for this second term as a president.
Well, he's not only getting the Peace Prize, he's certainly not getting the prize for organizing military parades either. Because anyway, we'll get to that.
Just on Trump, though, I mean, is he still in a position to negotiate a peace deal, do you think?
I don't think he's in a position to do very much on foreign policy because people need to know what actions you're likely to take if X or Y doesn't happen, or that you'll maintain a certainty of position and stay the course. And he doesn't either. So, even if he now threatened Iran in some way, so what? Who knows whether he'll do it or not? So he's a big man for a talk. And a little man for action. And that's been on tariffs. It's been all foreign policy. It's just all noise. And maybe that works at home where people get excited about some of the stuff that he says. But overseas, people are just like, it's a boy who cried wolf again, just talking nonsense.
Yeah, look, I don't think he's sorry, go on.
No, I mean, I just feel like whatever Trump does or says, people don't take that much. I mean, we take notice of it, but do we actually believe that what he says today is going to do tomorrow? The answer is no.
Look, there's no doubt not many in the international community take what Trump says on one day all that seriously, because as you said, it could very well change tomorrow. And Adam, coming to your question, I think I honestly think a lot of this is out of Trump's hands now, considering that there are a number of factors at play here. Obviously, it'll be interesting to see what China does over the next week or two. The other complication here is, for example, if there is a bit of an uprising, and it could well happen. Not only Netanyahu has been urging the Iranians to uprise against to Khomeini, but you've had Reza Pahlavi, who is the eldest son of the last Shah of Iran. He's written to a letter to the citizens of Iran. A good friend of mine here, raised my attention to it, and he's basically saying that Iran is yours and yours to claim, trying to motivate and trying to get people to rise up against the regime. I mean, if you've got these sorts of things at play, I can't see that the Iranian regime, if they're weak internally and fighting off some sort of potential uprising, they're not going to go and talk peace. I mean, it's just going to make them more and more, I think, determined to talk the anti-Zionist rhetoric, anti-West rhetoric, just to be able to shore up the kind of fundamentalist and the strong kind of anti-West sentiment locally. So I think that's what's got probably going to happen. So there's a lot of unknowns here, and there's a lot of ways that it can go. Of course, an uprising and some sort of descent towards the regime and toppling the regime. Maybe one of the objectives and could possibly happen, but we've also got to worry about what comes next. I can't see too many moderates sitting on the sidelines waiting to take over in this environment. I think that those who are probably going to have the power, they could very well be much more aggressive and much more conservative than the current regime. So it's all of a wait and see game, I think.
Do you not think that we fool ourselves? I say we, this is the Western perspective on these things that these governments don't have a degree of popular support, and that the people are just waiting for this opportunity to overthrow them. A lot of the time that proves not to be necessarily the case. And Afghanistan's a great example where the Taliban weren't long at coming back into power. And yeah, there'll be people who oppose them, but actually the ones where there is regime change and it sort of sticks is where you have a ruling class who's from a different religious sect than the majority of the people, and that's where it actually works. And that's not the case with Iran. It's a Shia leadership for a Shia population. So
Look,
I.
all I say is, I think I agree with you. It's hard to tell, but on the flip side, it's also hard to tell just how much support the regime also has, because we just don't have the visibility. We don't know if having people support you through force and coercion, etc. I'm not sure that's also a sustainable model for them.
No, but it can't just be that if they've been in power for as long as they have, through generations. That would be, I mean, I'm maybe looking at these things and I look at even post-Soviet Union, Russia had the opportunity to embrace democracy and they were a little bit more comfortable with what they had before. And I know that you can say there's oppression and there's reasons why people don't rise up and so on. But the truth is, if enough people were angry in a strong enough way, things would change. There'd be a critical mass around an alternative idea, which a lot of them don't seem to have. I mean, what is a democratic Iran look like? I don't think anyone really knows. So it's not something that
No,
people can say, oh, that's my ambition, because there's obviously going to be a heavy dose of religious politics in any future Iran, and invariably these things pull people back into that type of, theocracy or half theocracy or whatever it happens to be.
I mean, there's no doubt that the regime has support. I don't think anyone's arguing that. But the problem is, the regime, I think, probably has as much support as it has people opposing it. The issue is there's nothing there for people to get behind that would be a credible alternative,
Which is
because
fair enough. Yeah, I
there's
agreed.
because nothing's been able to cultivate as a credible alternative. So that's why most people are probably going, okay, well. They're probably thinking what we're just thinking now, thinking, well, if I topple this regime, I might get something worse. And look, years of propaganda against the West, years of religious theocracy, all of these things obviously play a very big role in having a society that is going to find it very difficult to get behind change, even though they may want to, because let's face it, at the end of the day, it's not that change is not clear. It's not clear to us. And you can imagine when you live in a place like Iran, it would be probably even less clear what change looks like.
Yeah, there's an emotional difference between change that comes through a feeling of victory and change that comes through a feeling of defeat. I think that's maybe one of
Absolutely.
the key factors.
Absolutely.
So, what friends do Iran actually hold in the region and around the world? We touched on it a little bit in terms of the reaction from the international community, which has been a I don't want to say pro-Israel, but I guess pro-dismantling of the nuclear, weapons that allegedly exist in Iran. But the question that I'm getting to is the scaling up of this conflict and the bringing in of other actors outside of the US. Let's just leave them to the side for a second. Can we see any support for Iran coming? Role do countries like Turkey play, particularly the president speaking to the Iranian president earlier today? How do we see that playing out, and are we w as worried as I guess we have been in similar Middle Eastern conflicts in the past, or should we be?
I'm happy to kind of take a stab at that. I don't think, I can't see right now any country coming to the aid of Iran. Russia has its own problems. I think China probably doesn't see it as a very smart move from its geopolitical position and where it sits. I think the only way that you're going to have I suppose, a more regional war is if Iran starts to provoke regional interests, such as attacking the shipping lanes that go through the Gulf, one of the biggest and busiest shipping lanes that's exporting and trading oil around the world. I think that's when you're going to see others get involved beyond just Israel. I mean, people have been talking about a potential Pearl Harbor type of scenario where Iran attacks one of the many bases, the US bases that are in the area, some of them being around Bahrain and others. I don't think Iran would be in a position to do that. I don't think that's very smart for them. But at the end of the day, I don't. It doesn't serve Iran's interest to start a broader regional war at this point in time, because I don't think anyone's really going to come to their aid. I don't think Turkey is in a position. Well, Turkey certainly can't be going to Iran's aid, but may play some sort of role in terms of brokering some sort of deal. But yeah, I don't think it's traditional allies are not in any position to be involved. It doesn't suit China in the slightest to be involved in this conflict. And Russia, as much as in the past may have wanted to jump into this conflict, Russia's having a difficult time trying to win a war against Ukraine. So I can't think of any other countries. I mean, not North Korea, perhaps, but you know,
They have
that's.
good relations with Venezuela, Ozan. I don't know whether you think Venezuela is going to tip the military balance in the Middle East or not.
Well, they probably got more chance of making an impact than Russia might at this point in time.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I hadn't thought of Venezuela as a serious contender, but yeah, it's good.
I was just scratching my brain for
Yeah,
any sort of potential Iranian ally.
scraping the bottom of the barrel there.
Yeah.
Well, let's see where it goes, obviously. And as we've said, it's nervous and uncertain times, but we'll continue to discuss it as it comes up. Speaking of uncertain times, what is happening in the US? We had a shooting over the weekend, and one of the biggest manhunts that went underway. Ozan, take us through what it was, what happened, and what the consequences were.
Yes, a tragic incident over the weekend of political violence against the Minnesota Senate leader, I believe she is, and effectively a gunman attacked a number of lawmakers, was able to kill Republican Melissa Hortman. So she's a former Speaker of the Minnesota House, and also her husband, Mark Hortman, and attacked State Senator John Hoffman and her husband as well. So the alleged shooter, gentleman by the name of Vance Luther Bolter, who just before we started recording, I believe, has been taken into custody after one of the most, or probably the biggest manhunts in Minnesota history. He is a gentleman who had been appointed to a number of different government positions, predominantly by the previous governor, and had been renewed under the current governor Tim Walz and vice presidential candidate last year. He had a list of 70 other targets that he had put together, all Democratic legislators and people who are quite actively involved in Democratic politics. And he has been, it has been found out that he's a registered Republican. His neighbor and others have made it very clear that he voted for Trump. He's a Trump supporter. And also he's left, I think, a manifesto and a bunch of things that point very strongly towards some quite strong views that he has, anti-abortion views, I believe, and you know, views around quite right-wing type of and Christian fundamentalist views that he holds. So obviously, once this happened, you had the MAGA and the ecosystem running around saying that this was a Democrat that was shooting Democrats. Kind of got you know that didn't very go very far, that argument, and it's become obvious that it's a case of right-wing terrorism, and it's very, very sad, and I think is another sign and another indication that you know someone needs to get up and take some leadership in the US and just tone down the rhetoric, because this is getting really, really out of hand. And you know, this is something that is, he has been able to murder people, but you know, those who have not been able to do so. But I think on a daily basis, some lawmakers are receiving multiple number of death threats, etc. Just this is not, this shouldn't be happening in a country like the US.
Yeah, I think the thing for me is whether it opens up a debate about safety of elected representatives and understanding where political division doesn't turn into something more extreme. But I think in the US, it's hard to differentiate between those two things at times. But I also think this incident is so unusual that it'll be characterized as a one-off. People will park it and they'll just move on. Although obviously the suspect was arrested rather than killed, and therefore there's going to be some potential for trial coverage and all those other things that wouldn't have happened in the future, trial coverage and further discussion about motive and so on that may have, as a conversation, died with the suspect, as often happens in these cases where suicide by police or something is what the outcome actually is. So maybe that gives us a chance of having a broader debate, but I think it'll just be parked as isolated. People will criticize this chap, and then they'll just move on, and it'll not be sufficiently associated with the Trump Republicans for there to be any real political damage.
Well, particularly at a time where so much is happening from a support and an anti sort of Trump movement perspective, and so much of the rhetoric is starting to change, and we're seeing this in focus groups as well in the US and playing out on all sorts of both mainstream and social media as well. But particularly over the weekend, where a military parade celebrating the 250th year anniversary of the US military was sort of juxtaposed with protests against Donald Trump by a movement called the No Kings Movement that saw thousands of people on the streets across the United States. Ozan, is this sort of divisive scene that we're seeing across the US starting to really feel a little bit typical of what we're going to expect throughout his presidency? Or is this a case, do you think, of, well, this is just how modern politics sort of operates these days?
I hope not. I hope this is not going to be what it's like for the next 3.5 years, but I think it may well be, because you're right. I think modern politics, pretty much, well, particularly in the US, is very much characterized by serious division, tribalism, and what have you. And that was certainly on display during the weekend when we had, as you mentioned, a military parade to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the US Army, which also coincided with Donald Trump's 79th birthday. Now, we criticize North Korea for a lot of things, starving its people, murdering its people. But one thing that they can certainly do is put on a decent military parade. And I think Donald Trump's got a lot to learn when it comes to putting on military parades, because this thing was blown up to be an amazingly patriotic, something that was going to really get the patriotic juices flowing and get the country behind it, etc. They were expecting 250,000 people in Washington, D.C. And effectively, they got. I'll put it to you this way: I went to a wedding, Adam, and I reckon I had a small wedding, but yours was bigger. So I reckon you had more people at your wedding than attended this this military parade. It was a complete flop, and he looked like he was about to start crying through most of it, because he realized that nobody had turned up. Basically, the estimates are about 10 to 20,000 people. It was low energy. There was absolutely no music. There was nothing, because when you run a military parade, like an actual king did during the weekend in the UK, King Charles ran a military parade. There's got to be a vibe. There's got to be something that has. You've got to have speakers everywhere blasting out patriotic music, etc. But I mean, this was amateur hour. Basically, a bunch of poor soldiers were driving around down the street in tanks, and others were kind of marching behind them. There's no music, there was no soul, there was no real vibe or anything like that. Lucky Pete Hegseth is not Secretary of Defense in a place like North Korea, because he's yeah, he wouldn't have lasted very long after such a poor parade. But look, jokes aside, it was a disappointment. I think it's a big kick in the guts for him, particularly when in most cities around the country, particularly not just big cities, but even medium-sized cities, etc., you've got attendance at the No Kings rally that you mentioned of almost four, five, six, in some cases 10 times more people than that turned up to the rally. And I think it's a the mood is changing, the mood is shifting. And I think people, and the No Kings movement was smart. They brought in a very big umbrella, and it was a very kind of broad appeal of people that, you know, they kind of tried to get out onto the streets. And there was very few instances of violence. It was 99% peaceful, and people were just, I think, trying to get the message across that they're not happy with the way things are going, and they don't want a king. And you know, it was supposed to be in response to the military parade, which, mind you, cost $45 million. It was supposed to be in response to that, but what it was actually in the end, because of the week that Trump had with the Elon Musk issue and the LA, you know, calling in the National Guard into Los Angeles, etc., I think really motivated many people to come out and generally protest the direction in which the country is going. So, this might be a turning point. I think things might calm down a little bit after this because, you know, let's face it, the Trump administration and those around him came into power 6 months ago claiming that they have a mandate to pretty much do anything that they wanted. And bit by bit and slowly, they're kind of getting pulled back to reality and realizing, well, actually, no, the US is still somewhat resembling a democracy, and we're not able to get away with a lot of the things that we want to get away with.
I find what I find interesting. All right, so I find it really boring. The parade boring, the protest against the parade boring. I think there's more things to protest in America than whether Donald Trump has to waste money on a stupid parade, notionally for his birthday or for 249 years of the US Army. What I find interesting was all the Republicans who went on the media to push the line that the protesters were paid. I thought that was remarkable. And then everyone said these paid protesters, paid protesters. These are paid protesters. And I was like, right. But no one ever said who was paying them. And that was a bit of a disappointment. It was like reading some great detective novel and someone ripping out the last page. You don't know who actually the killer was.
Of course, it's George Soros, mate. There's
Oh,
no
is it
other
George
way.
Soros?
Of
Ah,
course, of course.
sorry. I didn't, so that was what was on the last page. But yeah, these paid protesters. I mean, this America is just lunacy. And there'll be a lot of people who'll believe that there were paid protesters. No Kings
What?
even sounds crap as well as a protest movement. Do you know what I mean? They could have come up with something a bit better than that.
There's a lot of excitement. I know, Rodney, you didn't get excited, but there's a lot of excitement around this. I'm sure you guys have seen it, but it's this 3.5% rule, and it basically it goes. It's a theory that had been developed by a lady called Erica Chenoweth, who's a political scientist at Harvard, and she did a whole big research into resistance movements over the last 100 years, and found that any kind of sustained, organized, and non-violent protest that's able to engage 3.5% of the population ultimately ends up in success. So it ends up in kind of a better outcome, whether it's, you know, trying to topple over an autocratic, you know, leader, or trying to pull back on some of the autocratic practices of leaders, etc. And this has gone viral, completely viral now, and is everywhere, because there's claims that, and these are only claims because it's very hard to I suppose confirm and, you know, verify these things. But there's claims that basically over 12 million, 11 or 12 million people were out protesting on the weekend, which represents more than 3.5%. So, if this is sustained and continues to be non-violent, you know, history shows that that many of the things that people are protesting against, you know, may be overturned. So let's see.
Yeah, so I'm still skeptical on the three. I've read about the 3.5% rule, Luzanne, but I always thought it was down to the 50% plus one rule. But let's see.
Well, that's if you continue to have elections, my friend.
Yeah, fair enough.
And to bring us home for this week, speaking of paying people to go from one location to another, The G7 is taking place, and the biggest seven economies and the leaders of those countries will be getting together to discuss, well, perhaps things that they didn't think they would be discussing at this G7 just a few days ago. That just shows, I think, how volatile the world is at the moment and how quickly things will change. Rodney, what's the headline act, do you think, at G7, and what should we expect from the talks?
Well, Macron going to Greenland en route is clearly the biggest news story, so that he can compare notes with Vance on whether they visited the same top 10 Greenlandic tourist attractions on TripAdvisor.
Who got a better reception?
He didn't have to pay homeless people to come into a burger bar to talk to him, so that was
George great Soros success. Did it for him.
Yeah. So, but look, they'll have been going there to talk about Ukraine. How they support Ukraine, and that's because obviously beyond the EU, it's going to involve, the Canadians obviously as a host, but also Japan, etc. But maybe some discussion around tariffs. But now the conversation is going to be consumed to an extent by what's happening in the Middle East and how to try and de-escalate that problem. But I do wonder whether European and G7 leaders are just going to be a little bit less tolerant of Trump than they have been in their one-to-ones and their silly Oval Office meetings and so on. And I do wonder whether patience is wearing a little bit thin, and whether Trump, despite his thick skin and hypersensitivity, if it's possible to have both, he seems to manage it, is going to start feeling that, a little bit of hostility, because look who they've invited. Because it's the G7 plus the invitees. And I think Carney's invited the European Union, not a friend of Trump's. Mexico, brilliant. That's another warm relationship for Trump. And Zelensky. So again, not really someone that Trump has a successful personal relationship with. So I think to an extent it's going to be thrown from tariffs in Ukraine to have a lot more focus on what's happened in the Middle East. But I'll be interested to see the body language and how the other leaders are interacting with Trump, whether they continue to try and be all admiring and deferential and so on, or whether they're going to find it hard to hide what they really think of him.
Look, I mean, I think it's sad to say, because I can tell you what they should be talking about if they're actually committed to effectively solving some of the major issues that we're facing as a global community. But what they're going to end up talking about is probably something that Trump says on day one, or something that Trump does. This is what's going to be the agenda. Trump will not give up the opportunity to steal the limelight. I mean, he's there. He's the leader of the superpower. As Rodney said, they all probably have had enough of him. But he will do everything he can to put the attention back on him. Whatever that is, that's what they're going to be talking about, and that's what is going to be the kind of news headlines, which is very sad, because let's face it, there's a few things that they should be talking about, such as Iran, Israel conflict, the Russia conflict, what's happening in Gaza. All of the things that Trump came into power saying he was going to fix, he's made worse pretty much. Those are the things that they should be talking about and focused on to fix. And not to mention the kind of threat of a major global recession that might be coming our way. We find out in about 3 or 4 weeks the second quarter GDP numbers, and it's not looking great. So lots to talk about, but yep, it'll be the Trump show again, and he'll Still the limelight.
Well, let's see where they end up, and no doubt something we can dissect next week. Gents, wonderful unpacking the chaos of the week and the weekend with you both this week. See you next.
Thanks.
Thank you.